One of the first to imply that diverse sets of measurements share common characteristics was Jacob Bernoulli's nephew Daniel. In 1777, he likened the random errors in astronomical observation to the deviations in the flight of an archer's arrows. In both cases, he reasoned, the target, true value of the measured quantity or the bullseye, should lie somewhere near the center, and the observed results should be bunched around it, with more reaching the inner bands and fewer falling farther from the mark. The law he proposed to describe the distribution did not prove to be the correct one, but what is important is the insight that the distribution of an archer's errors might mirror the distribution of errors in astronomical observations. That the distribution of errors follows some universal law, sometimes called the error law, is the central precept on which the theory of measurement is based. Its magical implication is that, given that certain very common conditions are satisfied, any determination of a true value based on measured values can be solved employing a single mathematical analysis. When such a universal law is employed, the problem of determining the true position of a heavenly body based on a set of astronomers' measurements is equivalent to that of determining the position of a bullseye given only the arrow holes or a wine's quality given a series of ratings. That is the reason mathematical statistics is a coherent subject rather than merely a bag of tricks. Whether your repeated measurements are aimed at determining the position of Jupiter at 4 a.m. on Christmas Day, or the weight of a loaf of raisin bread coming off an assembly line, the distribution of error is the same. This doesn't mean random error is the only kind of error that can affect measurement. If half a group of wine critics liked only red wines, and the other half only white wines, but they all otherwise agreed perfectly, and agreed perfectly consistent, then the ratings earned by a particular wine should not follow the error law, but instead should consist of two sharp peaks, one due to the red wine lovers and one due to the white wine lovers. But even in situations where the applicability of the law may not be obvious, from the point spreads of football games to IQ ratings, the error law often does apply. Many years ago, I got hold of a few thousand registration cards for a consumer software program a friend had designed for 8- and 9-year-olds. The software wasn't selling as well as expected. Who was buying it? After some tabulation, I found that the greatest number of users occurred at age 7, indicating an unwelcome but not unexpected mismatch. But what was truly striking was that when I made a bar graph showing how the number of buyers diminished as the buyer's age strayed from the mean of 7, I found that the graph took a familiar shape, that of the error law. It is one thing to suspect that archers and astronomers, chemists and marketers, encounter the same error law. It is another to discover the specific form of the law. Driven by the need to analyze astronomical data, scientists like Daniel Bernoulli and Laplace postulated a series of flawed candidates in the 18th century. As it turned out, the correct mathematical function describing the error law, the bell curve, had been under their noses the whole time. It had been discovered in London in a different context many decades earlier. Of the three people instrumental in uncovering the importance of the bell curve, its discoverer is one who least often gets the credit. Abraham de Moivre's breakthrough came in 1733, when he was in his mid-60s, and wasn't made public until his book, The Doctrine of Chances, came out in its second edition 5 years later. De Moivre was led to the curve while searching for an approximation to the numbers that inhabit the regions of Pascal's triangle far beneath the place where I truncated it, hundreds or thousands of lines down. In order to prove his version of the law of large numbers, Jacob Bernoulli had had to grapple with certain properties of the numbers that appeared in those lines. The numbers can be very large. For instance, one coefficient in the 200th row of Pascal's triangle is 59 digits. In Bernoulli's day, and indeed in the days before computers, such numbers were obviously very hard to calculate. That's why, as I said, Bernoulli proved his law of large numbers employing various approximations, which diminished the practical usefulness of his result. With his curve, de Moivre was able to make far better approximations to the coefficients and therefore greatly improve on Bernoulli's estimates. The approximation de Moivre derived is evident if, as I did for the registration cards, you represent the numbers in a row of the triangle by the height of the bars on a bar graph. For instance, the three numbers in the third line of the triangle are 1, 2, and 1. In their bar graph, the first bar rises 1 unit, the second is twice that height, and the third is again just 1 unit. Now let's look at the five numbers in the fifth line, 1, 4, 6, 4, 1. That graph will have 5 bars. Again, starting low, rising to a peak in the center, and then falling off symmetrically. The coefficients are very far down in the triangle, leading to bar graphs with very many bars, but they behave in the same manner. If you draw a curve connecting the tops of all the bars in each bar graph, it will take on a characteristic shape, a shape approaching that of a bell. And if you smooth the curve a bit, you can write a mathematical expression for it. That smooth bell curve is more than just a visualization of the numbers in Pascal's triangle. It is a means for obtaining an accurate and easy-to-use estimate of the numbers that appear in the triangle's lower lines. This was de Moivre's discovery. Today, the bell curve is usually called the normal distribution and sometimes the Gaussian distribution. We'll see later where that term originated. The normal distribution is actually not a fixed curve, but a family of curves, in which each depends on 2 parameters to set its specific position and shape. The first parameter determines where its peak is located. The second parameter determines the amount of spread in the curve. Though it didn't receive its modern name until 1894, this measure is called the standard deviation, and it is the theoretical counterpart of the concept I spoke of earlier, the sample standard deviation. Roughly speaking, it is half the width of the curve at the point at which the curve is about 60% of its maximum height. Today, the importance of the normal distribution stretches far beyond its use as an approximation to the numbers in Pascal's triangle. It is, in fact, the most widespread manner in which data have been found to be distributed. When employed to describe the distribution of data, the bell curve describes how, when you make many observations, most of them fall around the mean, which is represented by the peak of the curve. Moreover, as the curve slopes symmetrically downward on either side, it describes how the number of observations diminishes equally above and below the mean, at first rather sharply, and then less drastically. In data that follow the normal distribution, about 68%, roughly two-thirds, of your observations will fall within 1 standard deviation of the mean, about 95% within 2 standard deviations, and 99.7% within 3. A good way to get a feeling for how the normal distribution relates to random error is to consider the process of polling or sampling. You may recall the poll I described in Chapter 5 regarding the popularity of the mayor of Basel. In that city, a certain fraction of voters approved of the mayor, and a certain fraction disapproved. For the sake of simplicity, we will now assume each was 50%. As we saw, there is a chance that those involved in the poll would not reflect exactly this 50-50 split. In fact, if N voters were questioned, the chances that any given number of them would support the mayor are proportional to the numbers on line N of Pascal's triangle. And so, according to de Moivre's work, if pollsters poll a large number of voters, the probabilities of different polling results can be described by the normal distribution. In other words, about 95% of the time, the approval rating they observe in their poll will fall within two standard deviations of the true rating, 50%. Pollsters use the term margin of error to describe this uncertainty. When pollsters tell the media that a poll's margin of error is plus or minus 5%, they mean that if they were to repeat the poll a large number of times, 19 out of 20, 95% of those times, the result would be within 5% of the correct answer. Though pollsters rarely point this out, this also means, of course, that about one time in 20 the result will be wildly inaccurate. As a rule of thumb, a sample of 100 yields a margin of error that is too great for most purposes. A sample of 1,000, on the other hand, usually yields a margin of error in the ballpark of 3%, which, for most purposes, suffices. It is important, whenever assessing any kind of survey or poll, to realize that when it is repeated, we should expect the results to vary. For example, if in reality 40% of registered voters approve of the way the president is handling his job, it is much more likely that six independent surveys will report numbers like 37, 39, 39, 40, 42, and 42, than it is that all six surveys will agree that the president's support stands at 40%. Those six numbers are in fact the results of six independent polls gauging the president's job approval in the first 2 weeks of September 2006. That's why, as another rule of thumb, any variation within the margin of error should be ignored. But although the New York Times will not run the headline, "Jobs and Wages Increased Modestly at 2 p.m., analogous headlines are common in the reporting of political polls. For example, after the Republican National Convention in 2004, CNN ran the headline, "Bush Apparently Gets Modest Bounce." The experts at CNN went on to explain that Bush's convention bounce appeared to be 2 percentage points. The percentage of likely voters who said he was their choice for president rose from 50 right before the convention to 52 immediately afterward. Only later did the reporter remark that the poll's margin of error was plus or minus 3.5 percentage points, which means that the newsflash was, essentially, meaningless. Apparently the word "apparently" in CNN talk means apparently not. For many polls, a margin of error of more than 5% is considered unacceptable. Yet in our everyday lives, we make judgments based on far fewer data points than that. People don't get to play 100 years of professional basketball, invest in 100 apartment buildings, or start 100 chocolate chip cookie companies. And so when we judge their success at those enterprises, we judge them on just a few data points. Should a football team lavish $50 million to lure a guy coming off a single record-breaking year? How likely is it that the stockbroker who wants your money for a sure thing will repeat her earlier successes? Does the success of the wealthy investor of Sea Monkeys mean there is a good chance he'll succeed with his new ideas of invisible goldfish and instant frogs? For the record, he didn't. When we observe a success or a failure, we observe one data point, a sample from under the bell curve that represents the potentialities that previously existed. We cannot know whether our single observation represents the mean or the outlier, an event to bet on or a rare happening that is not likely to be reproduced. But at a minimum, we ought to be aware that a sample point is just a sample point. And rather than accepting it simply as reality, we ought to see it in the context of the standard deviation or the spread of possibilities that produced it. The wine might be rated 91, but that number is meaningless if we have no estimate of the variation that would occur if the identical wine were rated again and again by someone else. It might help to know, for instance, that a few years back, when both the Penguin Good Australian Wine Guide and On Wine's Australian Wine Annual reviewed the 1999 vintage of the Mitchelton Blackwood Park Riesling, the Penguin Guide gave the wine 5 stars out of 5 and named it Penguin Best Wine of the Year, while On Wine rated it at the bottom of all the wines it reviewed, deeming it the worst vintage produced in a decade. The normal distribution not only helps us understand such discrepancies, but also has enabled a myriad of statistical applications widely employed today in both science and commerce. For example, whenever a drug company assesses whether the results of a clinical trial are significant, a manufacturer assesses whether a sample of parts accurately reflects the proportion of those that are defective, or a marketer decides whether to act on the results of a research survey. The recognition that the normal distribution describes the distribution of measurement error came decades after de Moivre's work, by that fellow whose name is sometimes attached to the bell curve, the German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss. It was while working on the problem of planetary motion that Gauss came to that realization, at least regarding astronomical measurements. Gauss's proof, however, was, by his own later admission, invalid. Moreover, its far-reaching consequences also eluded him, and so he slipped the law inconspicuously into a section at the end of a book called The Theory of the Motion of Heavenly Bodies Moving About the Sun in Conic Sections. There it may well have died, just another in the growing pile of abandoned proposals for the error law. It was Laplace who plucked the normal distribution from obscurity. He encountered Gauss's work in 1810, soon after he had read a memoir to the Académie des Sciences, proving a theorem called the Central Limit Theorem, which says that the probability that the sum of a large number of independent random factors will take on any given value is distributed according to the normal distribution. For example, suppose you bake 100 loaves of bread, each time following a recipe that is meant to produce a loaf weighing 1,000 grams. By chance, you will sometimes add a bit more or a bit less flour or milk, or a bit more or less moisture may escape in the oven. If in the end each of a myriad of possible causes adds or subtracts a few grams, the central limit theorem says that the weight of your loaves will vary according to the normal distribution. Upon reading Gauss's work, Laplace immediately realized that he could use it to improve his own, and that his work could provide a better argument than Gauss's to support the notion that the normal distribution is indeed the error law. Laplace rushed to press a short sequel to his memoir on the theorem. Today, the central limit theorem and the law of large numbers are the two most famous results of the theory of randomness. To illustrate how the central limit theorem explains why the normal distribution is the correct error law, let's reconsider Daniel Bernoulli's example of the archer. I played the role of the archer one night after a pleasant interlude of wine and adult company when my younger son Nikolai handed me a bow and arrow and dared me to shoot an apple off his head. The arrow had a soft foam tip, but still it seemed reasonable to conduct an analysis of my possible errors and their likelihood. For obvious reasons, I was mainly concerned with vertical errors. A simple model of the errors is this. Each random factor, say a sighting error, the effect of air currents, and so on, would throw my shot vertically off target, either high or low, with equal probability. My total error in aim would then be the sum of my errors. If I was lucky, about half the component errors would deflect the arrow upward and half downward, and my shot would end up right on target. If I was unlucky, or, more to the point, if my son was unlucky, the errors would all fall one way and my aim would be off, either high or low. The relevant question was, how likely was it that the errors would cancel each other, or that they would add up to their maximum, or that they would take any other value in between? But that was just a Bernoulli process, like tossing coins and asking how likely it is that the tosses will result in a certain number of heads. The answer is described by Pascal's triangle, or, if many trials are involved, by the normal distribution. And that, in this case, is precisely what the central limit theorem tells us. As it turned out, I missed both apple and sun, but did knock over a glass of very nice Cabernet. By the 1830s, most scientists had come to believe that every measurement is a composite, subject to a great number of sources of deviation and hence to the error law. The error law and the central limit theorem thus allowed for a new and deeper understanding of data and their relation to physical reality. In the ensuing century, scholars interested in human society also grasped these ideas and found to their surprise that the variation in human characteristics and behavior often displays the same pattern as the error in measurement. And so, they sought to extend the application of the error law from physical science to a new science of human affairs. Chapter 8. The Order in Chaos. In the mid-1960s, some 90 years old and in great need of money to live on, a Frenchwoman named Jeanne Calment made a deal with a 47-year-old lawyer. She sold him her apartment for the price of a low monthly subsistence payment, with the agreement that the payments would stop upon her death, at which point she would be carried out and he could move in. The lawyer must have known that Ms. Calment had already exceeded the French life expectancy by more than 10 years. He may not have been aware of Bayes' theory, however, nor known that the relevant issue was not whether she should be expected to die in minus 10 years, but that her life expectancy, given that she had already made it to 90, was about 6 more years. Still, he had to feel comfortable believing that any woman who, as a teenager, had met Vincent van Gogh in her father's shop would soon be joining van Gogh in the hereafter. For the record, she found the artist dirty, badly dressed, and disagreeable. 10 years later, the attorney had presumably found an alternative dwelling, for Jeanne Calment celebrated her 100th birthday in good health. And though her life expectancy was then about 2 years, she reached her 110th birthday, still on the lawyer's dime. By that point, the attorney had turned 67. But it was another decade before the attorney's long wait came to an end. And it wasn't the end he expected. In 1995, the attorney himself died, while Jeanne Calment lived on. Her day of reckoning finally came on August 4, 1997, at the age of 122. Her age at death exceeded the lawyer's age at his death by 45 years. Individual lifespans and lives are unpredictable. But when data are collected from groups and analyzed en masse, regular patterns emerge. Suppose you have driven accident-free for 20 years. Then, one fateful afternoon while you're on vacation in Quebec with your spouse and your in-laws, your mother-in-law yells, "Look out for that moose!" and you swerve into a warning sign that says essentially the same thing. To you, the incident would feel like an odd and unique event. But as the need for the sign indicates, in an ensemble of thousands of drivers, a certain percentage of drivers can be counted on to encounter a moose. In fact, a statistical ensemble of people acting randomly often displays behavior as consistent and predictable as a group of people pursuing conscious goals. Or, as the philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote in 1784, "Each, according to his own inclination, follows his own purpose, often in opposition to others. Yet, each individual and people, as if following some guiding thread, go toward a natural, but to each of them, unknown goal. All work toward furthering it, even if they would set little store by it, if they did know it." According to the Federal Highway Administration, for example, there are about 200 million drivers in the United States. And, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, in one recent year, those drivers drove a total of 2.86 trillion miles. That's about 14,300 miles per driver. Now, suppose everyone in the country had decided it would be fun to hit that same total again the following year. Let's compare two methods that could have been used to achieve that goal. In Method 1, the government institutes a rationing system, employing one of the National Science Foundation's supercomputing centers to assign personal mileage targets that meet each of the 200 million motorists' needs, while maintaining the previous annual average of 14,300. In Method 2, we tell drivers not to stress over it, and to drive as much or as little as they please with no regard to how far they drove the prior year. If Uncle Billy Bob, who used to walk to work at the liquor store, decides instead to log 100,000 miles as a shotgun wholesaler in West Texas, that's fine. And if Cousin Jane, in Manhattan, who logged most of her mileage circling the block on street cleaning days in search of a parking space, gets married and moves to New Jersey, we won't worry about that either. Which method would come closer to the target of 14,300 miles per driver? Method 1 is impossible to test, though our limited experience with gasoline rationing indicates that it probably wouldn't work very well. Method 2, on the other hand, was actually instituted. That is, the following year, drivers drove as much or as little as they pleased without attempting to hit any quota. How did they do? According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that year, American drivers drove 2.88 trillion miles, or 14,400 miles per person, only 100 miles above target. What's more, those 200 million drivers also suffered within less than 200, the same number of fatalities in both years, 42,815 versus 42,643. We associate randomness with disorder. Yet although the lives of 200 million drivers vary unforeseeably, in the aggregate, their behavior could hardly have proved more orderly. Analogous regularities can be found if we examine how people vote, buy stocks, marry, are told to get lost, misaddress letters, or sit in traffic on their way to a meeting they didn't want to go to in the first place. Or if we measure the length of their legs, the size of their feet, the width of their buttocks, or the breadth of their beer bellies. As 19th century scientists dug into newly available social data, wherever they looked, the chaos of life seemed to produce quantifiable and predictable patterns. But it was not just the regularities that astonished them. It was also the nature of the variation. Social data, they discovered, often followed the normal distribution. That the variation in human characteristics and behavior is distributed like the error in an archer's aim led some 19th century scientists to study the targets toward which the arrows of human existence are aimed. More important, they sought to understand the social and physical causes that sometimes move the target. And so, the field of mathematical statistics, developed to aid scientists in data analysis, flourished in a far different realm, the study of the nature of society. Statisticians have analyzed life's data at least since the 11th century, when William the Conqueror commissioned what was, in effect, the first national census. William began his rule in 1035 at age 7, when he succeeded his father as Duke of Normandy. As his moniker implies, Duke William II liked to conquer, and in 1066 he invaded England. By Christmas Day, he was able to give himself the present of being crowned king. His swift victory left him with a little problem. Whom exactly had he conquered? And more important, how much could he tax his new subjects? To answer those questions, he sent inspectors to every part of England to note the size, ownership, and resources of each parcel of land. To make sure they got it right, he sent a second set of inspectors to duplicate the effort of the first set. Since taxation was based not on population but on land and its usage, the inspectors made a valiant effort to count every ox, cow, and pig, but didn't gather much data about the people who shoveled their droppings. Even if population data had been relevant, in medieval times, a statistical survey regarding the most vital statistics about humans, their lifespans, and diseases, would have been considered inconsistent with the traditional Christian concept of death. According to that doctrine, it was wrong to make death the object of speculation, and almost sacrilegious to look for laws governing it. For whether a person died from a lung infection, a stomach ache, or a rock whose impact exceeded the compressive strength of his skull, the true cause of his or her death was considered to be simply God's will. Over the centuries, that fatalistic attitude gradually gave way, yielding to an opposing view, according to which, by studying the regularities of nature and society, we are not challenging God's authority, but rather learning about his ways. A big step in that transformation of views came in the 16th century, when the Lord Mayor of London ordered the compilation of weekly bills of mortality to account for the christenings and burials recorded by parish clerks. For decades, the bills were compiled sporadically, but in 1603, one of the worst years of the plague, the city instituted a weekly tally. Theorists on the continent turned up their noses at the data-laden mortality bills as peculiarly English and of little use. But, to one peculiar Englishman, a shopkeeper named John Grant, the tallies told a gripping tale. Grant and his friend William Petty have been called the founders of statistics, a field sometimes considered lowbrow by those in pure mathematics, owing to its focus on mundane practical issues. And in that sense, Grant in particular makes a fitting founder. For unlike some of the amateurs who developed probability, Cardano, the doctor, Fermat, the jurist, or Bayes, the clergyman, Grant was a seller of common notions. Buttons, thread, needles, and other small items used in a household. But Grant wasn't just a button salesman. He was a wealthy button salesman, and his wealth afforded him the leisure to pursue interests having nothing to do with implements for holding garments together. It also enabled him to befriend some of the greatest intellectuals of his day, including Petty. One inference Grant gleaned from the mortality bills concerned the number of people who starved to death. In 1665, that number was reported to be 45, only about double the number who had died from execution. In contrast, 4,808 were reported to have died from consumption, 1,929 from spotted fever and purples, 2,614 from teeth and worms, and 68,596 from the plague. Why, when London was teeming with beggars, did so few starve? Grant concluded that the populace must be feeding the hungry, and so he proposed instead that the state provide the food, thereby costing society nothing, while ridding the 17th century London streets of their equivalent of panhandlers and squeegee men. Grant also weighed in on the two leading theories of how the plague is spread. One theory held that the illness was transmitted by foul air. The other, that it was transmitted from person to person. Grant looked at the week-to-week records of deaths and concluded that the fluctuations in the data were too great to be random, as he expected they would be if the person-to-person theory were correct. On the other hand, since weather varies erratically week by week, he considered the fluctuating data to be consistent with the foul air theory. As it turned out, London was not ready for soup kitchens, and Londoners would have fared better if they had avoided ugly rats rather than foul air. But Grant's great discoveries lay not in his conclusions. They lay instead in his realization that statistics can provide insights into the system from which the statistics are derived. Petty's work is sometimes considered a harbinger of classical economics. Believing that the strength of the state depends on and is reflected by the number and character of its subjects, Petty employed statistical reasoning to analyze national issues. Typically, his analyses were made from the point of view of the sovereign, and treated members of society as objects to be manipulated at will. Regarding the plague, he pointed out that money should be spent on prevention because, in saving lives, the realm would preserve part of the considerable investment society made in raising men and women to maturity, and therefore would reap a higher return than it would on the most lucrative of alternative investments. Regarding the Irish, Petty was not as charitable. He concluded, for example, that the economic value of an English life was greater than that of an Irish one, so the wealth of the kingdom would be increased if all Irishmen, except a few cowherds, were forcibly relocated to England. As it happened, Petty owned his own wealth to those same Irish. As a doctor with the invading British army in the 1650s, he had been given the task of assessing the spoils and assessed that he could get away with grabbing a good share for himself, which he did. If, as Petty believed, the size and growth of a population reflect the quality of its government, then the lack of a good method for measuring the size of a population made the assessment of its government difficult. Grant's most famous calculations address that issue, in particular the population of London. From the bills of mortality, Grant knew the number of births. Since he had a rough idea of the fertility rate, he could infer how many women were of childbearing age. That datum allowed him to guess the total number of families and, using his own observations of the mean size of a London family, thereby estimate the city's population. He came up with 384,000. Previously, it was believed to be 2 million. Grant also raised eyebrows by showing that much of the growth of the city was due to immigration from outlying areas, not to the slower method of procreation, and that despite the horrors of the plague, the decrease in population due to even the worst epidemic was always made up within 2 years. In addition, Grant is generally credited with publishing the first life table, a systematic arrangement of life expectancy data that today is widely employed by organizations, from life insurance companies to the World Health Organization, that are interested in knowing how long people live. A life table displays how many people, in a group of 100, can be expected to survive to any given age. In 1662, Grant published his analyses in Natural and Political Observations Upon the Bills of Mortality. The book met with acclaim. A year later, Grant was elected to the Royal Society. Then, in 1666, the Great Fire of London, which burned down a large part of the city, destroyed his business. To add insult to injury, he was accused of helping to cause the destruction by giving instructions to halt the water supply just before the fire started. In truth, he had no affiliation with the water company until after the fire. Still, after that episode, Grant's name disappeared from the books of the Royal Society. Grant died of jaundice a few years later. Largely because of Grant's work, in 1667 the French fell in line with the British and revised their legal code to enable surveys like the Bills of Mortality. Other European countries followed suit. By the 19th century, statisticians all over Europe were up to their elbows in government records such as census data, an avalanche of numbers. Grant's legacy was to demonstrate that inferences about a population as a whole could be made by carefully examining a limited sample of data. But though Grant and others made valiant efforts to learn from the data through the application of simple logic, most of the data's secrets awaited the development of the tools created by Gauss, Laplace, and others in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The term statistics entered the English language from the German word Statistik through a 1770 translation of the book Bielefeld's Elementary Universal Education, which stated that the science that is called statistics teaches us what is the political arrangement of all the modern states of the known world. By 1828, the subject had evolved such that Noah Webster's American Dictionary defines statistics as a collection of facts respecting the state of society, the condition of the people in a nation or country, their health, longevity, domestic economy, arts, property, and political strength, the state of their country, etc. The field had embraced the methods of Laplace, who had sought to extend his mathematical analysis from planets and stars to issues of everyday life. The normal distribution describes the manner in which many phenomena vary around a central value that represents their most probable outcome. In his Essai philosophique sur la probabilité, Laplace argued that this new mathematics could be employed to assess legal testimony, predict marriage rates, calculate insurance premiums. But by the final edition of that work, Laplace was in his 60s, and so it fell to a younger man to develop his ideas. That man was Adolphe Quetelet, born in Ghent, Flanders, on February 22, 1796. Quetelet did not enter his studies spurred by a keen interest in the workings of society. His dissertation, which in 1819 earned him the first doctorate in science awarded by the new university in Ghent, was on the theory of conic sections, a topic in geometry. His interest then turned to astronomy, and around 1820 he became active in a movement to found a new observatory in Brussels, where he had taken a position. An ambitious man, Quetelet apparently saw the observatory as a step toward establishing a scientific empire. It was an audacious move, not least because he knew relatively little about astronomy and virtually nothing about running an observatory. But he must have been persuasive because not only did his observatory receive funding, but he personally received a grant to travel to Paris for several months to remedy the deficiencies in his knowledge. It proved a sound investment, for Quetelet's Royal Observatory of Belgium is still in existence today. In Paris, Quetelet was affected in his own way by the disorder of life, and it pulled him in a completely different direction. His romance with statistics began when he made the acquaintance of several great French mathematicians, including Laplace and Joseph Fourier, and studied statistics and probability with Fourier. In the end, though he learned how to run an observatory, he fell in love with a different pursuit, the idea of applying the mathematical tools of astronomy to social data. When Quetelet returned to Brussels, he began to collect and analyze demographic data, soon focusing on records of criminal activity that the French government began to publish in 1827. In Sur l'homme et le développement de ses facultés, a two-volume work he published in 1835, Quetelet printed a table of annual murders reported in France from 1826 to 1831. The number of murders, he noted, was relatively constant, as was the proportion of murders committed each year, with guns, swords, knives, canes, stones, instruments for cutting and stabbing, kicks and punches, strangulation, drowning, and fire. Quetelet also analyzed mortality according to age, geography, season, and profession, as well as in hospitals and prisons. He studied statistics on drunkenness, insanity, and crime, and he discovered statistical regularities describing suicide by hanging in Paris and the number of marriages between 60-something women and 20-something men in Belgium. Statistics had conducted such studies before, but Quetelet did something more with the data. He went beyond examining the average to scrutinizing the manner in which the data strayed from its average. Wherever he looked, Quetelet found the normal distribution, in the propensities to crime, marriage, and suicide, and in the height of American Indians and the chest measurements of Scottish soldiers. He came upon a sample of 5,738 chest measurements in an old issue of the Edinburgh Medical and Surgical Journal. In the height of 100,000 young Frenchmen called up for the draft, he also found meaning in a deviation from the normal distribution. In that data, when the number of conscripts was plotted against their height, the bell-shaped curve was distorted. Too few prospects were just above 5'2", and a compensating surplus was just below that height. Ketola argued that the difference, about 2,200 extra short men, was due to fraud, or, you might say, friendly fudging, as those below 5'2" were excused from service. Decades later, the great French mathematician, Jules-Henri Poincaré, employed Ketola's method to nab a baker who was shortchanging his customers. At first, Poincaré, who made a habit of picking up a loaf of bread each day, noticed after weighing his loaves that the average was about 950 grams, instead of the 1,000 grams advertised. He complained to the authorities and afterward received bigger loaves. Still, he had a hunch that something about his bread wasn't kosher. And so, with the patience only a famous, or at least tenured, scholar can afford, he carefully weighed his bread every day for the next year. Though his bread now averaged closer to 1,000 grams, if the baker had been honestly handing him random loaves, the number of loaves heavier and lighter than the mean should have, as I mentioned in Chapter 7, diminished following the bell-shaped pattern of the error law. Instead, Poincaré found that there were too few light loaves and a surplus of heavy ones. He concluded that the baker had not ceased baking underweight loaves, but instead was seeking to placate him by always giving him the largest loaf he had on hand. The police again visited the cheating baker, who was reportedly appropriately astonished, and presumably agreed to change his ways. Ketola had stumbled on a useful discovery. The patterns of randomness are so reliable that in certain social data, their violation can be taken as evidence of wrongdoing. Today, such analyses are applied to reams of data too large to have been analyzed in Ketola's time. In recent years, in fact, such statistical sleuthing has become popular, creating a new field called forensic economics, perhaps the most famous example of which is the statistical study suggesting that companies were backdating their stock option grants. The idea is simple. Companies grant stock options, the right to buy shares later at the price of the stock on the date of the grant, as an incentive for executives to improve their firm's share prices. If the grants are backdated to times when the shares were especially low, the executive's profits will be correspondingly high. A clever idea, but when done in secret, it violates securities laws. It also leaves a statistical fingerprint, which has led to the investigation of such practices at about a dozen major companies. In a less publicized example, Justin Wolfers, an economist at the Wharton School, found evidence of fraud in the results of about 70,000 college basketball games. Wolfers discovered the anomaly by comparing Las Vegas bookmakers' point spreads to the game's actual outcomes. When one team is favored, the bookmakers offer point spreads in order to attract a roughly even number of bets on both competitors. For instance, suppose the basketball team at Caltech is considered better than the team at UCLA. For college basketball fans, yes, this was actually true in the 1950s. Rather than assigning lopsided odds, bookies could instead offer an even bet on the game, but pay out on a Caltech bet only if their team beat UCLA by, say, 13 or more points. Though such point spreads are set by the bookies, they are really fixed by the mass of bettors because the bookies adjust them to balance the demand. Bookies make their money on fees and seek to have an equal amount of money bet on each side so that they can't lose, whatever the outcome. To measure how well bettors assess two teams, economists use a number called the forecast error, which is the difference between the favored team's margin of victory and the point spread determined by the marketplace. It may come as no surprise that forecast error, being a type of error, is distributed according to the normal distribution. Wolfers found that its mean is zero, meaning that the point spreads don't tend to either overrate or underrate teams, and its standard deviation is 10.9 points, meaning that about two-thirds of the time the point spread is within 10.9 points of the margin of victory. In a study of professional football games, a similar result was found, with a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 13.9 points. When Wolfers examined the subset of games that involved heavy favorites, he found something astonishing. There were too few games in which the heavy favorite won by a little more than the point spread, and an inexplicable surplus of games in which the favorite won by just less. This was again Catala's anomaly. Wolfer's conclusion, like Catala's and Poincaré's, was fraud. His analysis went like this. It is hard for even a top player to ensure that his team will beat a point spread. But if the team is a heavy favorite, a player, without endangering his team's chance of victory, can slack off enough to ensure that the team does not beat the spread. And so if unscrupulous bettors want to fix games without asking players to risk losing, the result would be just the distortions Wolfers found. Does Wolfers' work prove that in some percentage of basketball games, players are taking bribes to shave points? No, but as Wolfer says, you shouldn't have what's happening on the court reflect what's happening in Las Vegas. And it is interesting to note that in a recent poll by the National Collegiate Athletic Association, 1.5% of players admitted knowing a teammate who took money for playing poorly. Catala did not pursue the forensic applications of his ideas. He had bigger plans. To employ the normal distribution in order to illuminate the nature of people and society. If you made 1,000 copies of a statue, he wrote, those copies would vary due to errors of measurement and workmanship, and that variation will be governed by the error law. If the variation in people's physical traits follows the same law, he reasoned, it must be because we too are imperfect replicas of a prototype. Catala called that prototype the average man. He felt that a template existed for human behavior, too. The manager of a large department store may not know whether the spacey new cashier will pocket that half-ounce bottle of Chanel Allure she was sniffing, but he can count on the prediction that in the retail business, inventory loss runs pretty steadily from year to year at about 1.6%, and that consistently about 45 to 48% of it is due to employee theft. Crime, Catala wrote, is like a budget that is paid with frightening regularity. Catala recognized that the average man would be different for different cultures, and that it could change with changing social conditions. In fact, it is the study of those changes and their causes that was Catala's greatest ambition. Man is born, grows up, and dies according to certain laws, he wrote, and those laws have never been studied. Newton became the father of modern physics by recognizing and formulating a set of universal laws. Modeling himself after Newton, Catala desired to create a new social physics, describing the laws of human behavior. In Catala's analogy, just as an object, if undisturbed, continues in its state of motion, so the mass behavior of people, if social conditions remain unchanged, remains constant. And just as Newton described how physical forces deflect an object from its path, so Catala sought laws of human behavior, describing how social forces transform the characteristics of society. For example, Catala thought that vast inequalities of wealth and great fluctuations in prices were responsible for crime and social unrest, and that a steady level of crime represented a state of equilibrium, which would change with changes in the underlying causes. A vivid example of such a change in social equilibrium occurred in the months after the attacks of September 11, 2001, when travelers, afraid to take airplanes, suddenly switched to cars. Their fear translated into about 1,000 more highway fatalities in that period than in the same period the year before. Hidden casualties of the September 11th attack. But to believe that a social physics exists is one thing, and to define one is another. In a true science, Catullus realized, theories could be explored by placing people in a great number of experimental situations and measuring their behavior. Since that was not possible, he concluded that social science is more like astronomy than physics, with insights deduced from passive observation. And so, seeking to uncover the laws of social physics, he studied the temporal and cultural variation in the average man. Catullus's ideas were well received, especially in France and Great Britain. One physiologist even collected urine from a railroad station urinal frequented by people of many nationalities in order to determine the properties of the average European urine. In Britain, Catullus's most enthusiastic disciple was a wealthy chess player and historian named Henry Thomas Buckle, best known for an ambitious multi-volume book called History of Civilization in England. Unfortunately, in 1861, when he was 40, Buckle caught typhus while traveling in Damascus. Offered the services of a local physician, he refused because the man was French. And so, he died. Buckle hadn't finished his treatise, but he did complete the initial two volumes, the first of which presented history from a statistical point of view. It was based on the work of Catullus and was an instant success. Read throughout Europe, it was translated into French, German, and Russian. Darwin read it. Alfred Russel Wallace read it. Dostoevsky read it. Twice. Despite the book's popularity, the verdict of history is that Catullus's mathematics proved more sensible than his social physics. For one thing, not all that happens in society, especially in the financial realm, is governed by the normal distribution. For example, if film revenue were normally distributed, most films would earn near some average amount, and 2/3 of all film revenue would fall within a standard deviation of that number. But in the film business, 20% of the movies bring in 80% of the revenue. Such hit-driven businesses, though thoroughly unpredictable, follow a far different distribution, one for which the concepts of mean and standard deviation have no meaning because there is no typical performance, and mega-hit outliers, which in an ordinary business might occur only once every few centuries, happen every few years. More important than his ignoring other probability distributions, though, is Catullus's failure to make much progress in uncovering the laws and forces he sought. So in the end, his direct impact on the social sciences proved modest. Yet his legacy is both undeniable and far-reaching. It lies not in the social sciences, but in the hard sciences, where his approach to understanding the order in large numbers of random events inspired many scholars and spawned revolutionary work that transformed the manner of thinking in both biology and physics. It was Charles Darwin's first cousin who introduced statistical thinking to biology. A man of leisure, Francis Galton had entered Trinity College, Cambridge, in 1840. He first studied medicine, but then followed Darwin's advice and changed his field to mathematics. He was 22 when his father died, and he inherited a substantial sum. Never needing to work for a living, he became an amateur scientist. His obsession was measurement. He measured the size of people's heads, noses, and limbs, the number of times people fidgeted while listening to lectures, and the degree of attractiveness of girls he passed on the street. London girls scored highest, Aberdeen lowest. He measured the characteristics of people's fingerprints, an endeavor that led to the adoption of fingerprint identification by Scotland Yard in 1901. He even measured the lifespans of sovereigns and clergymen, which, being similar to the lifespans of people in other professions, led him to conclude that prayer brought no benefit. In his 1869 book, Hereditary Genius, Galton wrote that the fraction of the population in any given range of heights must be nearly uniform over time, and that the normal distribution governs height and every other physical feature, circumference of the head, size of the brain, weight of the gray matter, number of brain fibers, and so on. But Galton didn't stop there. He believed that human character, too, is determined by heredity and, like people's physical features, obeys in some manner the normal distribution. And so, according to Galton, men are not of equal value as social units, equally capable of voting and the rest. Instead, he asserted, about 250 out of every 1 million men inherit exceptional ability in some area, and as a result become eminent in their field. As in his day, women did not generally work, he did not make a similar analysis of them. Galton founded a new field of study based on those ideas, calling it eugenics, from the Greek words eu, meaning good, and genos, meaning birth. Over the years, eugenics has meant many different things to many different people. The term and some of his ideas were adopted by the Nazis, but there is no evidence that Galton would have approved of the Germans' murderous schemes. His hope, rather, was to find a way to improve the condition of humankind through selective breeding. Much of Chapter 9 is devoted to understanding the reasons Galton's simple cause-and-effect interpretations of success is so seductive. But we'll see in Chapter 10 that because of the myriad of foreseeable and chance obstacles that must be overcome to complete a task of any complexity, the connection between ability and accomplishment is far less direct than anything that can possibly be explained by Galton's ideas. In fact, in recent years, psychologists have found that the ability to persist in the face of obstacles is at least as important as a factor in success as talent. That's why experts often speak of the 10-year rule, meaning that it takes at least a decade of hard work, practice, and striving to become highly successful in most endeavors. It might seem daunting to think that effort and chance, as much as innate talent, are what counts. But I find it encouraging because, while our genetic makeup is out of our control, our degree of effort is up to us. And the effects of chance, too, can be controlled to the extent that by committing ourselves to repeated attempts, we can increase our odds of success. Whatever the pros and cons of eugenics, Galton's studies of inheritance led him to discover two mathematical concepts that are central to modern statistics. One came to him in 1875 after he distributed packets of sweet pea pods to 7 friends. Each friend received seeds of uniform size and weight, and returned to Galton the seeds of the successive generations. On measuring them, Galton noticed that the median diameter of the offspring of large seeds was less than that of the parents, whereas the median diameter of the offspring of small seeds was greater than that of the parents. Later, employing data he obtained from a laboratory he had set up in London, he noticed the same effect in the height of human parents and children. He dubbed the phenomenon, that in linked measurements, if one measured quantity is far from its mean, the other will be closer to its mean, regression toward the mean. Galton soon realized that processes that did not exhibit regression toward the mean would eventually go out of control. For example, suppose the sons of tall fathers would on average be as tall as their fathers. Since heights vary, some sons would be taller. Now, imagine the next generation, and suppose the sons of the taller sons, grandsons of the original men, were also on average as tall as their fathers. Some of them, too, would have to be taller than their fathers. In this way, as generation followed generation, the tallest humans would be ever taller. Because of regression toward the mean, that does not happen. The same can be said of innate intelligence, artistic talent, or the ability to hit a golf ball. And so, very tall parents should not expect their children to be as tall. Very brilliant parents should not expect their children to be as brilliant. And the Picassos and Tiger Woodses of this world should not expect their children to match their accomplishments. On the other hand, very short parents can expect taller offspring. And those of us who are not brilliant or can't paint have reasonable hope that our deficiencies will be improved upon in the next generation. At his laboratory, Galton attracted subjects through advertisements, and then subjected them to a series of measurements of height, weight, even the dimensions of certain bones. His goal was to find a method for predicting the measurements of children based on those of their parents. One of Galton's plots showed parents' heights versus the heights of their offspring. If, say, those heights were always equal, the graph would be a neat line rising at 45 degrees. If that relationship held on average, but individual data points varied, then the data would show some scatter above and below that line. Galton's graphs thus exhibited visually not just the general relationship between the heights of parent and offspring, but also the degree to which the relationship holds. That was Galton's other major contribution to statistics, defining a mathematical index describing the consistency of such relationships. He called it the coefficient of correlation. The coefficient of correlation is a number between negative 1 and 1. If it is near, plus or minus 1, it indicates that two variables are linearly related. A coefficient of 0 means there is no relation. For example, if data revealed that by eating the latest McDonald's 1,000-calorie meal once a week, people gained 10 pounds a year, and by eating it twice a week, they gained 20 pounds, and so on, the correlation coefficient would be 1. If for some reason everyone were to instead lose those amounts of weight, the correlation coefficient would be negative 1. And if the weight gain or loss were all over the map and didn't depend on meal consumption, the coefficient would be 0. Today, correlation coefficients are among the most widely employed concepts in statistics. They are used to assess such relationships as those between the number of cigarettes smoked and the incidence of cancer, the distance of stars from Earth, and the speed with which they are moving away from our planet, and the scores students achieve on standardized tests, and the income of the students' families. Galton's work was significant not just for its direct importance, but because it inspired much of the statistical work done in the decades that followed, in which the field of statistics grew rapidly and matured. One of the most important of these advances was made by Carl Pearson, a disciple of Galton's. Earlier in this chapter, I mentioned many types of data that are distributed according to the normal distribution. But with a finite set of data, the fit is never perfect. In the early days of statistics, scientists sometimes determined whether data was normally distributed simply by graphing them and observing the shape of the resulting curve. But how do you quantify the accuracy of the fit? Pearson invented a method called the chi-square test, by which you can determine whether a set of data actually conforms to the distribution you believe it conforms to. He demonstrated his test in Monte Carlo in July 1892, performing a kind of rigorous repeat of Jagger's work. In Pearson's test, as in Jagger's, the numbers that came up on a roulette wheel did not follow the distribution they would have followed if the wheel had produced random results. In another test, Pearson examined how many fives and sixes came up in 26,306 tosses of 12 dice. He found that the distribution was not one you'd see in a chance experiment with fair dice, that is, in an experiment in which the probability of a 5 or a 6 on one roll were 1 in 3, or 0.3333. But it was consistent if the probability of a 5 or a 6 were 0.3377, that is, if the dice were skewed. In the case of the roulette wheel, the game may have been rigged, but the dice were probably biased owing to variations in manufacturing, which my friend Moshe emphasized are always present. Today, chi-square tests are widely employed. Suppose, for instance, that instead of testing dice, you wish to test three cereal boxes for their consumer appeal. If consumers have no preference, you would expect about 1 in 3 of those polled to vote for each box. As we've seen, the actual results will rarely be distributed so evenly. Employing the chi-square test, you can determine how likely it is that the winning box received more votes due to consumer preference rather than to chance. Similarly, suppose researchers at a pharmaceutical company perform an experiment in which they test two treatments used in preventing acute transplant rejection. They can use a chi-square test to determine whether there is a statistically significant difference between the results. Or suppose that before opening a new outlet, the CFO of a rental car company expects that 25% of the company's customers will request subcompact cars, 50% will want compacts, and 12.5% each will ask for cars in the midsize and other categories. When the data begin to come in, a chi-square test can help the CFO quickly decide whether his assumption was correct or the new site is atypical, and the company would do well to alter the mix.